Welcome to The Summit, a podcast focused on bringing you the knowledge and insights for industry leaders. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer, and I'm on a mission to help you exceed your potential. As a sales guy turned marketer, I am passionate about building sustainable businesses. And if there's one thing I've learned in my 20-year career, it's that you won't find an overnight growth scheme, a shortcut to success, or a way to hack yourself to the top. Nope. Success is the byproduct of hard work, great relationships, and deep understanding done over and over. We're here to help you unlock that success with some secrets from other people, one conversation at a time.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer, and today we're here with Matt Seltzer. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm super excited to have this conversation. For those of you who don't know Matt, Matt is a lifelong marketer who started his career conducting market research for one of the most decorated ad agencies in the Western U.S. He won't tell us the name, but they're a pretty big deal. Yep. He continued to maintain a steady freelance research career while simultaneously pursuing direct marketing opportunities and also teaching marketing courses.
Yep.
Matt's skills are diverse, man. He's done a little bit as it relates to market research, delivering marketing projects, doing digital campaigns, and is just a wealth of knowledge. Matt, we are super excited to have you here today. What did I miss?
No, you pretty much hit all of it. I play a bunch of musical instruments too, but that doesn't come up in marketing a lot.
Really? Like the ukulele or what? What's your jam?
Oh, I've got a trombone, a trumpet right here, and we're going to grab the recorder as well. So I got the gamut here.
Well, as long as it's not a sousaphone, I think we're all right.
Nope, no sousaphones.
That's fantastic. Well, today we're going to talk about market research, persona building, and how you're doing it wrong. Most companies don't realize it, but they're doing it all wrong. But before we get into that, Matt, give us just a little bit of the, you know, I touched on a few things briefly. What's your marketing career journey looked like up to this point? 3 minutes or less.
Yeah. So real quick. So I started at an ad agency in college. I was an intern and my foot in the door was with the research team. And actually it's because I knew 10 key. I was the only person who applied who knew how to do 10 key. But I fell in love with it. I thought I was okay. I'm just going to get my foot in the door with an ad agency. And I'm like, oh, this research thing is awesome. We're learning about audiences. We're doing surveys, focus groups. And I'm thinking, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And then 2008 happened and everyone said, no, you're not doing this for the rest of your life because everyone's getting laid off. And I got laid off. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to another ad agency and keep doing research. And I'm out here in Las Vegas. And what I found out is there are literally no other ad agencies in the entire state of Nevada that do research. So did a bunch of other things. I went in-house for a marketing team for a while. I've done a few other ad agencies. I've worked on some startups. And I've always really done that marketing, the marketing management piece. But I also love the research side. So I'd always pitch ideas like, let's do some surveys, let's do some focus groups, brand awareness. And then for a few years, I actually went in-house with the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority. So for anyone who doesn't know, that's what happens in Vegas, stays in Vegas. I got to work on that project for 4 years as their senior research analyst doing just research. And then a little over a year ago, I kind of went back to my thinking of, well, why don't all these ad agencies have a research team? And there's a lot of reasons why. A lot of it has to do with revenue, the size, and how people are building agencies. But the long end of the short of it is I thought, well, here's a thing that I can do very, very well. And now I own a consulting firm called S2 Research, and I partner with ad agencies that don't do research and add another revenue stream for them.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now,
today's topic is research, but it's really more personas as a byproduct of research.
Yep.
Why do so many organizations feel like they have to have 800 personas? Like, let's just start with that. Why is it it's like I need to have a persona for everything?
Sure. So I'll start with why I love personas, and because that's a great problem that I see a lot of places have. So we've taken this time with research to say, let's take all of our customers, every one of them, let's figure out what is the average, right? You know, what does the average customer make per year? What is the average thing they're buying for? And that's a great way to learn about your audience, except the one thing, and I heard this recently, no one in your audience actually has 2.3 kids. So that's what averages get us to, but it's not actually who is the person when you really dive into it. And then you think about any product in the world. And I should preface, anytime I talk about a hypothetical product, it's going to be a cheeseburger. So let's say you're selling cheeseburgers, right? Well, you can't just say the average person who buys my cheeseburger makes X amount of money per year or has this many kids. You got to think, why are they buying cheeseburgers? And so you might have, and let's just take McDonald's as an example, you might have moms and dads who are buying cheeseburgers for their kids. The reason they're buying, they're looking for price, they're looking for a quick meal, they're looking to get something their kids aren't going to be upset about. That's their focus for buying that cheeseburger. So that's that persona right there. And then separately, you might have a college student who's just looking to save a few bucks, can get a cheeseburger for under $5. God, remember when it used to be under a dollar? That was the great deal. But oh yeah, everything's changed. But still, so you got someone who's, they obviously don't have kids. They're not focused on kids. They just want to get themselves fed without breaking the bank. You got a million different reasons why someone would buy a cheeseburger. So those are personas. You're deciding what is the person, what is their motivation, et cetera. Now, like I said, not everyone, there is no one in your audience that has 2.3 kids. And you think, okay, I've got my parents here. I've got my college student. People say, well, but then there's two types of college student. There's late night college student who's buying at 2 a.m. their cheeseburger versus the guy who's buying at lunch. You think, who's the parent? Well, does that parent have one kid or two? Do they have boys versus girls? And you start to think, well, let's just build more personas. And that's the problem that you just nailed. Then everyone says, well, I'm going to dive into every possible reason someone could buy a cheeseburger, and I'm going to figure out who that person is. And there's a great saying that I heard from a movie years and years ago. It says, is the juice worth the squeeze? And that right there is the solution to how many buyer personas should I have? You know, you could say, I'm going to talk to parents and I'm going to sell them cheeseburgers because they need to eat, their kids need to eat, and they're focused on XYZ. That's probably as deep as you need to go. If I'm going to decide on a different marketing campaign for boys versus girls, as far as the children go, I'm going to do better marketing. I'll be the first to tell you, it's going to be better. But was it better enough that you made more money than just doing the one persona? That's where you got to ask yourself, is the juice worth the squeeze? If I do this effort, am I going to get the returns on it? And most of the time, the answer is no. So it's a fine line of, I don't want to just take an average of everyone. I don't want to dive down to every single consumer. But you got to start to kind of find that middle ground of, this is where it's beneficial to my marketing to know the customer this deep.
Well, you know, it's so a couple of things there. One, you're speaking my love language. I eat cheeseburgers like crazy. They might be my, they might be my love food. My wife is like, I really can't eat another cheeseburger.
All yours, honey. No, that's
exactly right.
Yeah.
I'll have a double double. Wait, what's that mean? That means I ordered one for her and one for me. She had a bite and I had two. But, you think about how tangible that is. And I don't know if you've seen this yet, but McDonald's just recently released their 2020 commercial in the UK for cheeseburgers.
Okay.
And this persona is targeted at teenage parents, single parents who are teenagers who are distracted, involved with things that are related to electronics. And what they were targeting was reminding the teen or reminding the child about the special part of the relationship through food. Mm-hmm. Now, to your point, man, they could have segmented this 1,000 different ways, and they could have done with two parents, one with one parents, but they went with what told the simplest story, created the right emotion to drive home the point, which is through a McDonald's meal, you can create something that's very nostalgic and yep. reminds the heart of what's going on during the holidays. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend you go watch it. I posted it on my LinkedIn.
I'm going to take a look. Yeah.
I posted it on my LinkedIn, one of my LinkedIn posts yesterday, the link to it. So it's really easy to find.
I'll take a look. I actually have you pulled up here. So this will be good.
That's awesome. But from my perspective, one of the things that I think is interesting about the big guys, the McDonald's, your Cokes, your Pepsis, these big consumer brands, they tend to actually have the resources to do all of this fractional multi-direction personas. And yet the people who get lost in the sauce are more the mid-sized mid-market businesses where they're like, oh my gosh, if I don't tell this exact story to everybody the right way, I'm going to lose out.
Yep.
Why do they think that companies struggle so much with that fear, with that, that focus?
So it's the unknown, first off. You nailed exactly why I had to build my business. Is I said that a lot of these ad agencies, and I shouldn't just say ad agencies, we're talking small to mid-sized marketing teams, aren't doing research. It's because, one, it's not a direct revenue driver, at least not initially. So, I don't know if you've experienced this. This has been my experience, but if you work in marketing, 24 hours is not enough of the day. So to say to someone, yeah, exactly. And someone says, oh, now I need you to do research on top of that. You go, no. add on to that the fact that research in the last 20 years, you know, if you want to dive into buyers and really figure out who is my persona, there's a lot of different tools on that, and a lot of them are complex. So here we got this expensive thing that's complex that no one has time to do. Unless you're a giant company with an in-house research team, it's probably getting lost to the wayside. Or, and this is to answer your question, the flip side of that is someone's heard a great speaker who says, you need buyer personas. You need to be doing this for your audience. And it's foreign to you. You've never really done this before. You've said, okay, here's $10 million, maybe not $10 million, $10,000 in software we got to buy and we're going to go use, which I'm not saying you have to, but a lot of businesses go that route and they think I need the end all be all end buyer persona. And to them, that means crap. I've got, I hope crap's okay on the show. But I've got dozens and dozens of different personas that I could be reaching here. And I got to build every single one of them out. And it just comes down to you're being thrust into a world that you're not spending every day in. I mean, any facet of marketing, if you've never done PR, for instance, and someone says, hey, go pitch the media, is that one reporter? Is it 1,000 reporters? Both answers seem right. And again, it comes from you do it long enough, you start to figure this out. But if it's your first time, 10th time even, it's kind of a scary little ocean to navigate.
Oh my God. It you know, having sat in the C-suite where there were times when the team came to us and they're like, all right, we need to do press releases. And I'd be like, I'd look at my team. I'd look at what we had. I'm like, do what you do best, outsource the rest, right? So we're automatically going, all right, who do we know that we can call that's pitching the media? Because it's not a core competency of what we have.
That's exactly it.
But coming around back to the research component, research is really intimidating, I think, for folks. And I think it's intimidating because, man, you have firmographics, you have demographics, you have company makeups, and all of a sudden you have all of these different things that go into understanding. How do you know where to start? How do you know where to begin for you when you're building these personas? What does it start with?
Sure. So every project I do in research starts with a brainstorm. I'm a huge fan of taking a creative approach to what I do. So brainstorms always start with, I sit down with a client, or if it's a marketing team, I sit down with that team because they know much, much more than I do. But more importantly, they know even more than they think they do. And that's where it really comes down. So we mentioned personas. One of the reasons you would ever do a persona is you're trying to figure out, how can I convert someone into a customer? And that comes back to buying triggers. Why are they going to be your customer in the first place? And we backtrack from there. Well, sitting down with a marketing team and saying, well, why are people buying from you now? Why do you think they should be buying? And that's going to start that research path. They're going to start to say, oh, we're luxury items. And so we're targeting more of an audience with a higher affinity for luxury items. And you start to bring a piece through your brain. Okay, how do we get to that? How do we learn about that audience? From there, I've got, so there's two different schools of thought in market research. There's quantitative, which is numbers. There's qualitative, which is the open-ended things like focus groups where you can't really measure, but you're getting a lot of information. So I've had an opportunity to work in both of those areas. And I like that because I come at it at all these projects from what is the best way to answer the questions we're going to try to answer. And that's how the buyer persona process works. Sometimes I'm conducting surveys. Sometimes I'm doing focus groups. Sometimes I'm doing Zoom interviews with people all around the country, one-on-one. But what I'm really trying to do is what's the best way to figure out, going back to the beginning, that buying trigger. Why does this person want to be my client's customer versus this person? What is it that the product or service that they're providing helps them do? And then from there, you can start to backtrack into, okay, this is who's buying the cheeseburger for cost. This is buying the cheeseburger for taste or convenience. And you can build an entire person around that.
Well, I mean, what it leans into is what I've been running around touting for years. So you stole the juice isn't worth the squeeze, or at least, you know, I thought it was mine. I probably borrowed it from somebody who'd heard it in the movie. I just made it my own. But the other thing that you seem to be touting, which, you know, it, at least for me, feels self-gratifying and that I'm right, is that it's really about the question, right? So it's about asking the right question, and the power of the research, the power of what you begin to understand about the customer has less to do with what the outcome is. Mm-hmm. Or what the research tells you, and is more about asking the right questions, and the power of decisions you make come from the questions. So how do I pick the right questions?
So that comes down to a lot of thinking through the process. So I'll give you a great example. I do a lot of surveys. Surveys aren't the end all be all, but they can kind of help you track out how are we going to ask question 1, 2, 3. And I say this because I actually just finished a project where my client had some very specific questions that they wanted to ask. You know, they wanted to ask them in certain places. And I take a lot of liberties when I write a survey because I have to think through the process. Well, one of the things they were asking, if we had asked it in the very beginning where they wanted to ask it, I know exactly the answer they would have got. They would have gotten the five-star review on every single piece because of the way the question was worded, because it was the opening question. I have this great line that I've used for years that surveys aren't report cards. We try to think of them as, I just want to get the five-star rating. If I did that, we've done a good job. Well, I could write a survey right now, and I guarantee I'll get you 5 stars because that's how I word the question.
You mean marketers are leading the witness in research programs? No way.
That's exactly the problem, which I'll be honest, if you're trying to publish reviews, do lead the leading questions. Get people to answer the question that you're trying to get them to answer. But if you're trying to learn something from a tactical standpoint, you got to take that as far out of the equation as possible. You need to figure out, how can I get the raw thought that they're thinking, not what I want them to say. In fact, most of the time I want to hear what I don't want them to say, because that's something I can use. You know, a lot of people in a lot of industries don't take feedback real well. My entire industry is raw feedback. And it's hard. It's tough to take some of this, especially I do a lot of customer experience measurement. A lot of customers aren't happy out there. And in fact, a lot of the ones who are willing to engage with the measurement are the unhappiest. But their feedback is probably the most beneficial that you can get from a marketing standpoint. If they're saying your customer experience, if they're saying your checkout counter is rude, the people running the teller are rude, that's your last finish line for doing the marketing. The whole point of marketing is to make a sale. If your cashier is rude, you need to know about that so you can fix it. That comes down to marketing, which comes back to market research. And it's about, I mean, I could ask a question that says, on a 1 to 5 scale, how awesome was my cashier? Well, you're going to get a 4 or 5 by phrasing it like that. But if you say, tell us about your experience with the cashier, you're going to get the ones. And you probably don't want the ones, but you need the ones.
Yeah, just don't ask me about that, about the self-checkout cashier, because sometimes I want to throw it out the window.
I understand that too. Oh God, we're not alone there.
You know, I think companies that deployed the self-checkouts and depleted their frontline retail cashiers, they asked questions, did market research the exact same way you just said. How awesome was your experience with this checkout? And they're like, oh, look, we have a 97% approval rating. Yeah, but I'm not going to tell you it was awesome because it was terrible, right?
Yep. Oh God, you're absolutely right. And I'll tell you another side of that. There's this great old skit from a British show. And if you like me, I can't remember what it is, but I watched it 2 weeks ago because we were in political season. And they said, basically, there was a series of polls done. This is 30 years ago in Britain, 40 years ago in Britain, but that says people are for selective service. And they said, okay, we'll just go conduct a poll that says they aren't. They said, well, how do you conduct a poll like that? They say, we ask them 5 or 6 questions before asking the selective service question that takes them down a path that says they're not into it. They say, well, do you think we should equip civilians with weapons? Well, of course not. Okay, do you think we should do selective service? Well, no. And you take them down a path. Now, I'm telling the statistics that I want to tell from that story. And there's a lot of marketing value from those kind of questions. But if you're trying to be analytical about your own processes, if you're trying to learn the most about your own customers, you got to take that thinking out of the equation.
Well, but I've got executives, Matt, that are breathing down my neck, and the executive swears up and down, this is exactly what's going on in the market, and we just need the research to prove it. How do you diffuse those types of situations when, from the top down, it doesn't matter what you seem to be coming back with, it was you just didn't do the research right?
So I love data, and it's not all about data, but I love data. And I've worked with a lot of executives who don't like data. And they have that exact thing. Hey, I need XYZ stats to prove my case. Now, I've done a few of those kind of projects, and it's big in especially investment circles. They're trying to get people to understand. But if you want critical feedback, again, we need to go back to the basics. So to answer your question, what I found with a lot of executives who just aren't as into data as possible, or as they could be, or at least they're not into it as much as I am, is I build tools that help them get there. So I'll give you a great example. I do a lot of surveys, and I take the data and I build dashboards from it. And for anyone who doesn't know, a dashboard is, it's just like a graph or a series of graphs, except you can interact with it. You say, you know, here's how many people come to your store on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and you click on Thursday and you can see all their preferences for just the third people who came on Thursdays. So I like building those kind of tools because executives, I've learned, even if they're not data people, they like to explore. They like to learn about their customers. So building tools like that where they can go and cut the data themselves and click and interact, they start to see what we're trying to do. And then I can go back when someone says, oh, I need you to prove something with statistics for me. And I said, well, that's not going to get you the definitive thing like we built last week, that thing that you dug playing around with, where you need to be able to get real information so you have something that you can play with and learn from. But it's not just about it's not just about dashboards. That's just one great example. Another thing that I love to do, I'm a huge talker. I love to give presentations and I'm a huge data geek and I'm fully aware that most people aren't. So when I give presentations all the time on data, but I very rarely talk about data. You mentioned story a few minutes ago. I tell stories in my presentations. I communicate something very factual and real that an executive can understand. That's not about 25% of the audience said this and 75%. It's like I could say, hey, if I talk to four customers, three are going to say this. And here's what that means. And they can wrap their heads around these stories about real customers. So I guess the answer to your question, how do you get people to understand the value of real raw information versus proving something with statistics? It's about learning to speak on their level. And so they can start to see the value in it from their own standpoint. And then it gets the gears turning. They get excited about it.
Well, look, I'm gonna put a little bit of words in your mouth, but it almost sounds like you build dashboards in order to convince other people that they're going down through the survey to open up their mind versus having them come in with a preconceived notion. It's a bit of the survey feeding that you were talking about before.
That's exactly right. And I mean, again, it comes down to psychology. We're trying to get into their brain as deep as we can. And again, I go back, you know, a lot of people think of surveys as just report cards. You know, it's 1 to 5 scale. How did I do? And the way I always say it, if you could go talk to 1,000 of your customers and ask them any question in the world, the only thing you want to say is, did you give me an A or an F on my customer experience? I mean, you could learn anything. Why did you come in today? How much did you spend? What are you doing afterwards? And you could build a whole marketing plan based around their answers.
Yeah, but you have to ask an open-ended question versus a grading question, right?
You know, there's a lot of different ways. You're right. The thing I do like though about the grading questions, and they're not all grading questions, is you can measure. You know, if everyone gives one, let's say you ask the 1 to 5 question, but you don't ask it on a how did we do. It's was the conversation you had what you expected on a 1 to 5 scale of totally expected to not at all what I expected. And you can start to map out what they're thinking from there, and you can measure. And I go back to my segments. So let's say you say, you know, did you come in here because you're trying to feed your kids or you're just trying to save $5 on a cheeseburger? And then from there, I could look at those two groups and say, well, the $5 cheeseburger people are rating the customer experience way higher than the kids one. And if the kids segment, why is their customer experience situation so negative? Is it that they're just too distracted by their kids to even pay attention to the interaction? And you can roadmap out from there, a million different ways to make that work for your marketing. Because like I said, at the end of the day, that final person is your finish line to your marketing. Again, all of this stuff connects, but I love it because at the end of the day, we're just getting real information to help us do better marketing.
Do better marketing. You know, it sounds to me, and again, I'm paraphrasing here, but what it sounds to me like is that part of what helps you geek out is the fact that you get this raw data that helps you craft a meaningful story. And what I don't understand is why so many people's personas are missing the story. They're missing the personality or the depth or the business pain or personal pain that they have in their arc because they're focused on the data. Why do those seem to be so separate when organizations or companies are going through, hey, I've got this CEO and here's his pain. He's got a knucklehead that's a CTO and he's not hitting his revenue number. Let's go ask a bunch of questions to figure out what tool to sell him. Where's the story? Like why do the personas miss those elements so often?
Well, first off, when a lot of businesses think of personas, they think of just demographics. And that comes back to classical thinking of, you go look on the Census Bureau right now, and I can pull any data I want about any audience in any state. And I can tell you from that, what percent are Hispanic? What percent are living in poverty, et cetera? We could build something from that. That's what we classically think as, I'm doing research, I'm looking at statistics. What a lot of marketing, especially now, has taught us, especially in the content marketing world, is it's not about who they are, it's how they think. And in fact, I'm quoting one of my favorite books. It's called The World's Best Buyer Persona System. It was written by a friend of mine, but the entire process is based on that. You know, knowing who they are is important. You know, I've done a lot. I mentioned, you know, what share is Hispanic? Well, I've done a lot of Hispanic marketing in my career, and you have to be authentic to that audience. You have to speak in their language, not necessarily Spanish, but literally their language. What are they, what matters to them? But that's still just who they are. It's not how they think. So what content marketing, for instance, has taught us is people actually go to Google now and ask a question. They don't say, I mean, people look up taco places near me, but they also look up, where's the best taco? And that'll literally be a search phrase. And if you can answer that in your marketing, we know that we could build a content marketing strategy around that. Except it doesn't stop at content marketing, that's marketing. You know, why is someone searching for the best taco? Well, they probably are hungry. And you could think through, well, why are they hungry? Is it dinner time? And we could build an entire marketing campaign around what someone who enjoys tacos. Okay, so it's not just burgers. I do tacos too. But someone who enjoys tacos, who's looking for dinner, and what matters to them? Is it price point? Is it flavor? Is it reviews? Are they an Instagram foodie? And thinking through, what are they going to achieve with this? You could build a story from that. Well, that's not data. A lot of the times that's not data. That's asking a very, like you said, open-ended question of what matters to you. But the way to think of it, and I even told someone this recently, a buyer persona is like chapter one of your story. It's, you're setting up the character. What is their pain? What are they trying to achieve? Chapter two is your business. Chapter two is where you go and solve their problem for them. And again, someone might be buying cheeseburger taco because of price. They might be buying it for flavor or convenience or a million different, well, it's not a million, but a few very specific reasons. And those are different stories. Those are different. And then come back to marketing. If someone's buying cheeseburgers based on price, 99 cent tacos, 99 cent cheeseburger, that's the top of your marketing message. Versus if someone's trying to feed their kids two happy meals plus dinner for the kids for under $4.99, and we'll get you in and out in 5 minutes. You might want to have a copywriter fix that a little bit. But it's, the story is different. And it starts with, you're not going to write chapter two unless you know what are they trying to achieve in chapter one?
You know, the thing that I think is really interesting about that is there are a few times in history where when you get the story right, it rewrites history in general. So I don't know, are you familiar with Claude Hopkins?
No.
So I'll drop a book for you to read. It's cool. It's like 120 to 200 pages. Big type font, really fast read. It's called Scientific Advertising.
Okay.
And so for anybody that's listening, go get it. It's like an $8 paperback copy. It's worth the read. In the book, Claude Hopkins talks about how he took direct sales techniques and he applied them to advertising. And his big claim to fame was when Pepperdine, I believe that's the name of the toothpaste company, in the 1940s and 50s, there was a big problem with dental health. Hygiene of the mouth was a big deal. Dentistry wasn't what it is today. People always had halitosis. And he was like, well, I want to, he had a friend who came to him. They had this minty back, baking soda, toothpaste stuff. And he was like, advertise it for me. Well, Claude Hopkins, instead of getting his normal commission fee or whatever for writing the ad, he took a percentage of the sales. He did it on a performance basis. Mm-hmm. And he wrote an ad that basically said, when you feel the film on your teeth, Pepperdine is like whatever you should, what you should reach for. Well, what he had done is he'd hit a reticular activator. He was doing the story that you're talking about. He had hit somebody when they were, they were thinking about, their dental health or their breath right after lunch. He knew when people were, and he is credited with changing the trajectory of the dental industry in the 40s and 50s with one series of ads for a specific toothpaste. Now, did he do a lot of research? Maybe, but if he had gone to people and said, on a scale of 1 to 5, how bad do you think your breath is after lunch? Or on a scale of 1 to 5, how much do you like your dentist? He probably wouldn't have found that moment, that reticular activator that made people think about his ad just by with the words that he wrote, what it drew up inside of them.
Yep.
And he told a story, right? In 15 words or less. I think the actual headline was like 8 words. So anyways, the story is fascinating to me, but it led to like $40 or $50 million. Think about that in the 1940s worth of sales for toothpaste, right? Like it was just,
isn't that incredible?
It's explosive what it meant for the industry. But he didn't have a persona. He wasn't targeting somebody specifically. He wasn't reverse engineering. He was just going after a specific pain. Mm-hmm. When you're doing research, do you ever find that there isn't really a bunch of different personas? It's just this really one common story point or one common pain that folks are struggling with, and it's over and over. Like, you don't need to segment it.
So that happens all the time. And that's actually the perfect scenario. You have one customer with a very specific problem that you can solve over and over and over. And a lot of times that happens. Now, what you might find when you dive into that, though, is the person behind, why are they solving that problem? Maybe there's two reasons for that. You know, again, I mentioned I do market research for ad agencies. Sometimes that means a lot of ad agencies get the value of that, but they don't know what they're going to do with that. So sometimes it's, let's talk about adding an additional revenue stream for you. Sometimes it's, let's just talk about making your existing marketing better. And that kind of goes back to our original of, they both have one problem. They're not doing research and they know they should be. But when you dive deeper, the why might be different. And the other part is, there's a lot of people who fit into both categories. You know, I have this a lot where your audience is, let's call it 500,000 people. And you've got two personas and they each have 300,000 people in it. You say, well, that's 600,000. Well, no, it's not, because a lot of people might worry about two different problems. And the great part is you put out marketing that says problem one and marketing that says problem two. Well, those people in the overlap, those are your big targets, because they're worried about both and you're speaking to them on both wavelengths. That's what matters to them. So there's always going to be overlap. You know, I mentioned you might have a college student looking to save money and they have kids and they still need to feed them. And now they're caring about both messages with our cheeseburgers. But a lot of the times it really is, especially when you have that great product market fit. You know, I have one product, I solve a very specific problem, and there's X number of people in my audience. That's very real, that's who you're talking to. The other side of the coin is, and this goes really deep, is you also have 10 million customers, however many customers you have, and everyone is a little bit different. You and I are both marketers, but we're different people. So again, it goes back, how far do you want to dive in to make your marketing even more relevant?
Well, I spend a lot of time in the MarTech space. There's 11,000 different marketing technologies.
Yeah.
I remember the days of when there were less than, 300, and here we are, it's this explosive growth. What's interesting that you're talking about here, though, is the fractionalization. Do I want to have, be able to serve 10,000 different customers, or do I want to be able to serve one customer 10,000 times? Do you see in the market research and when people are asking questions and building personas, do you get to see or glimpse into things that help with pricing or help with how you should position or build the market so that it's most effective in telling that story?
Yeah. And that's where it really gets exciting to me. So sometimes price is something we deal with. That's less of a pain point than I'm always surprised that's not the main trigger. Really comes down to, what are people trying to achieve? But what I love about that is we're constantly measuring, we're constantly learning what is it that they're trying to achieve with our product, and then optimizing on that. So, we think about marketing as we find someone, we get them interested, we convert them, and then eventually we make a sale, and then we're done. Except no, we're not. Most of the time, again, let's go back to our cheeseburgers. You buy a cheeseburger at McDonald's, you have a great experience, you're going to go back. But note that I said a great experience. I didn't say a great cheeseburger. every single component of the cheeseburger buying process, from the wait time to the sit down, which isn't so much a thing these days, but every piece of that determines whether or not someone's going to be a customer for life. And then eventually what we call a brand advocate. And you want to make someone a brand advocate. That's the person who does your marketing for you, because they go around telling everyone how great the cheeseburger experience was. You got to be measuring every single component of that experience. You know, there's a great stat from a company called Watermark. They did a study a few years ago. They looked at about 10 years of NASDAQ data, and they basically looked at every company on the NASDAQ and said, yes or no, do you have a customer experience plan? Are you measuring it? Are you doing something with it? And the companies that said yes overperformed the NASDAQ by about 40 points over those 10 years. And what that story tells us is that these are companies that are taking into account, what does that final interaction look like? What does the entire marketing bubble look like? Because I know once I've made an exchange with my customer, I've given them a product, they've given me money, I want them to come back. And how do I get them to come back? Well, I make that first experience awesome. And the next experience even more awesome. And all of that comes down to paying attention and getting information and doing something with that information.
Well, to me, it begs the question, how do you determine where to start? And do you start with the problem? Do you start with the story? Do you start with the demographics? Like, how do you begin to deconstruct that question that you're trying to answer, the story you're trying to tell, in a way that makes it compelling, or in a way in which it helps you understand it so that you can make it compelling?
Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite things to do is observe. And that's not the only way to do market research, but it's one of my favorite ways. Let's say you have a storefront, and you just sit in the corner and watch people and see where people are waiting, see where people are looking upset or frustrated. And we constantly optimize from that. So from there, it's about exploring. But really, step one is, well, let me back up. I've had a lot of great business advisors in my life, but one of them said, let's say you want to grow your revenue by 20% in a year. Well, that's a tough challenge. But let's say he says instead, okay, let's say you want to increase your lead generation by 5%. Well, 5% jump in lead gen, that's not that huge. We could focus on that. And then let's say you want to say, I want to convert 5% more leads. So same thing, if you're talking to 100 people and you convert 5% of them, or 5 of them, now you want to convert 10 of them. Again, these are reasonable numbers that you can improve on. But by improving leads by 5% and improving conversion by 5%, you've multiplied how effective you are. And it's a lot easier to do than 20% growth over a year. So it's the same thing here. Let's say we just sit in our storefront and watch customers, and we realize we've got long lines. And we say, okay, I already can make some judgment calls from what long lines represent. People are, they're thinking we're a time waster. They're thinking, you know, et cetera. And we think, how can we just improve that by 5%? Make our lines 5% less long. Maybe it's opening another register. Maybe it's improving the sales process. Maybe it's getting a scanner app so people can just buy things on their phone rather than even getting that out of there. But you improved customer experience right there by 5%. And then you can do something else. Or you can measure that and say, okay, what did 5% in increasing our getting people in and out time, what did that get us? Did it get us more customers in the door? Did it get repeat business more? And then you can keep diving into that. Well, if repeat business went up from making that, and repeat business got us a 20% growth, how can we further repeat business? So it all comes down to exploring and a lot of experimenting, which is really where I get excited about this stuff. You know, the digital marketing world, for instance, digital marketing has really tapped into market research. We can do A/B testing. So let's say you're sending out an email, and you're gonna send it to 10,000 people, but before you do that, you're gonna send 100 to this group and 100 to this group, and they're gonna have different subject lines. And the one with a better subject line, that's gonna go to the full 10,000. Well, that's market research. We can do those same kind of experiments on, did our lines get shorter? Did we sell more if we stopped charging 99 cents and ended on a zero instead? There's a million experiments you could do, but all of those are market research. And then the only thing where I say, before you start doing experiments, take the time to make some hypotheses, observing, talking to people, just sitting down with customers and asking questions. So your experiments are at least informed by something your customer has said or done. You're not just testing for the sake of testing.
Not just making a bunch of stuff up.
You can. It's fun. I wouldn't recommend it, but it, you know, you can. And there's some cool ideas that have come from that.
So have you, what you're talking about to me, and again, I'm looking for things that I've experienced in my life to try and draw parallels to. Are you familiar with what a Kaizen event is?
No. God, I feel like I'm under the gun today. No, I don't know any of this.
Oh, no. Well, this is okay. And the best way to explain this is in story form. So forgive me here is a moment we talk about this. But a Kaizen event is an event inside of the Ocean Conray. And I know I'm saying that wrong, but it's a Lean Six Sigma thinking methodology, a way of identifying or optimizing processes and improving things inside of an organization. Mm-hmm. Think A/B marketing on steroids. And I like the story that was the way that somebody explained a Kaizen event to me is think of Kaizen as the five whys. Okay. And the story goes like this. I think it was like 10 years ago, the Washington Monument in DC had a huge problem where the government was spending over $1 million a year just pressure washing it in order to keep it clean. Okay. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, why are we spending $1 million a year to pressure wash this monument? Mm-hmm. The pressure washing, it erodes it. It's hard on it. We're having to spend extra things on restoration to keep it up. Like, why are we spending all of this money? So the first question is why? Well, why? It was constantly getting covered in pigeon droppings. And people are like, well, why is it getting covered in pigeon droppings? Well, because it was a place where pigeons gathered. So the first question is why are we spending all this money? The second question is why is it covered in pigeon droppings? The third question they said was, why are these pigeons all congregating here? And we're not seeing this at the Lincoln or any of these other particular places. They said, oh, well, there's this special kind of spider that's over here in this area. And the question number four is, well, why is this spider here? Why is it that we have these particular spiders? Well, the reason that these spiders are here is because their flies are congregating around the monument. Well, why are we have the flies congregating around the monument? Because of the color of light that you're using. And so over a 5-week period and 5 questions asked, they were able to identify that it was costing them $1 million a year had to do with they were using the wrong light bulbs to light the monument at night. And when you take a step back and you look at that, it was a couple $100 fix to save them $1 million a year.
Yep.
So the Kaizen event is asking why, asking why, asking why, asking why. Can you give me an example? And I know I just told you this, but can you give me an example through research that you've done or people that you've worked with where taking the research a bit further in the persona helped tell a better story and identify the real why and saw a positive outcome on the other end?
Sure. I'll actually tell you one of my favorite case studies. It's not one of mine. In fact, I wish it was one of mine, but I tell it all the time. So milk, you go back to the late 80s and we used to see advertisements for milk where you would literally watch someone run a marathon. They're soaked in sweat. And they go and drink a jug of milk, right? Which I used to run a different life now. And the last thing I ever wanted when I ran was milk. I mean, it sits heavy in your stomach. But we had all of these ads that said milk, it does a body good. And I know we got to those ads because we asked people, well, why do you drink milk? What's in it for you? And people said, well, it's healthy. And of course, you know, if I want to get stronger, I need to drink milk. If I want a million reasons, but milk is healthy. And we give that information to a team of copywriters and they turn that into milk. It does a body good. But the problem is no one buys milk because it's healthy. We ask the question, why do you drink milk? And that's a totally different question than why do you buy milk? So let's back that up. Why do you buy milk? And this is exactly what happened in the early 90s. A team went in and interviewed many, many people and they said, why do you buy milk? And milk, actually, there's 3 reasons that people buy milk. One is that everyone grew up with milk. They're it's always in the fridge and they're expected to have milk. So why do you buy milk? I'm supposed to have it in my fridge. 2, why do you buy milk? Well, if you're at the store, you see milk, you say, do I have milk? Most people have no clue if they have enough milk, whether or not they do. It's just, I don't know. Let me spend the $3-4
bucks. That is so true.
Oh yeah. And then milk comes with a bonus on it of even if you have milk, I have no clue if it's good, which no one knows if their milk is good. So just in case you buy the milk. So why are you buying milk? I'm supposed to have it. I don't know if I even have enough. And if I do, I have no clue if it's turned into cheese. So just in case, I'm going to buy milk. And now that's a totally different reason. Why are we buying? And you hand, I need milk. I'm supposed to have it. I'm not sure if it's good. You hand that to a team of copywriters and they turn that into the question, got milk, which to this day is one of the, arguably the number one ad campaign in history. I've heard a couple that put it in the top three, but it comes down to why you're going back. It doesn't matter why people are drinking it. That was the original thinking. I know why people are drinking. It's healthy. Well, that's great, but I can't turn that into dollars. And at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to convert people to make a marketing decision. And just asking someone, hey, do you have milk? Do you got milk? That is a question that turned into copy, which ironically is a question. And it's the essence of why someone is buying. I mean, that's what we're really trying to do. We're trying to get someone to buy or to make do an action. And that comes down to very specific copy that pertains to very specific need states.
Oh my God, so you bringing milk up means that you absolutely now have to read Scientific Advertising, because they touch on the Department of Agriculture's kickoff campaign and what it meant to the USDA for the milk. Like when dairy farmers were about to go extinct or about to lose their shirt, the USDA kicked off a campaign. So this is the pre-story to your got milk, which is, where did that demand originally come from?
Oh, I'm gonna have to take a look at this book now. This is my kind of book.
Yeah, and it's a short, fast read. That's the part that I love the most about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of those good kind of books now. And then you just get ideas. You get to share some stories with people. Yeah, I'm going to take a look at this one.
So if I'm a marketer or a business owner, even an agency owner, and I'm listening to this and I'm like, okay, you guys are droning on and on about advertising and this persona and that. Why or what would be the benefit from an ROI? Like, how can you financially impact me by asking the right question or doing personas right or doing this market research? What's the actual brass tacks? How do you explain that to folks?
Yeah. So when we think of marketing, well, first off, when we think of marketing, a lot of people just think advertising. And I can tell you, any business on this planet can win in the advertising game with enough money. That's the short end of it. If you have a big enough advertising budget, you're gonna win. That doesn't help any business that doesn't have that huge advertising budget. And then let's expand that to marketing across the gamut. So we're talking digital, we're talking direct marketing, we're talking public relations. If you don't have that great budget, that unlimited budget, you need to be strategic, right? So we used to talk about, you need to talk to someone 3 times before they make a decision. Then it was 7, then it was 11. And now I've heard that it's countless because everyone's hearing so many messages that you can't make a decision.
I heard it was 19 yesterday. Yesterday I heard somebody done a social media research that you need to see a message 19 times before they make a buying decision. And I was like, oh dear God, you're going to run out of money before you ever actually get the mind share.
That's exactly right. The problem with that thinking, I think, is that a lot of that 19 is the spaghetti at the wall method. You know, they're putting the whole message out there. They say, okay, 19. So I need, let's say they see 1 out of every 3 of my billboards. So I need to put up 60 billboards and boom, they'll, you know, get to it. And then you throw in some digital marketing in there, et cetera. But we live in a time period where you could actually just look on Google, just on Google and just on Facebook and say, I'm just going to show my very influential ad to someone who has the problem that I'm trying to solve. Well, now you're maximizing your dollars. Maybe you're going to spend more per impression than that billboard would, but that impression is only to someone who cares about the thing that you're doing. So it's about targeting. It's about hyper-focused. It's not about sending out 1 million emails. It's about sending out 10 emails to 10 people who care. And that goes back to, well, what do they care about? Well, I need to figure that out through research. And that goes back to the buyer persona. And then really, we talked earlier about how do you have, what happens if you have 3, 5, 10 buyer personas? We'll go back to, what are the 3, 5, 10 things that people care about? And then you can turn those into marketing funnels. You could turn them into a digital campaign with some PR around it as well. You could build specific language into your emails that speak to what worries about them. Again, if they're focused on price, all your emails talk about price incentives. If they're worried about efficiency or whatever the heck your business solves for them, focus on that in your language. And again, I mean, we live in this time like HubSpot. HubSpot blows my mind right now. And there's 1 million tools like HubSpot. But what I love about it is I know that there's three or four different reasons someone comes to my website looking for market research. And from that point forward, they're going to receive a series of emails over the next 6-12 months. They're going to get 1-2 a week that tells their story. And it's different than the guy who has a different story. They're going to get specific language. They're going to get specific content that pertains to what they're concerned about. Because if they're not worried about price, they just want to do better marketing for their clients. All the emails I send them in the world about price isn't going to move them. It comes back to, again, it's not who they are. It's how they think.
You know, what it sounds like to me, and I think I heard you say it a little bit, is that marketing is becoming more and more like sales. And
oh, yeah.
The people that visit your marketing things don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And it sounds to me like the language of caring is understanding who they are, where they're at, and what's important to them.
Oh, you nailed it. And I'll tell you, that line between sales and marketing, it's so blurred now that you can't even see it anymore. And I love that, because it used to be that marketing does X and then we hand the ball to sales and they take it from there. And instead, I think it's, we're all in the business of slowly converting and building trust.
I could not agree more. And anybody who listens to my show on a regular basis, they'll hear me say that line between sales and marketing needs to understand how people sell and how people buy much more apropos than they have in the past. Because anytime you're engaging with somebody, if you can get their head nodding yes, you're actually doing a sales process. Things that were relied upon salespeople years ago, whether it was somebody selling an elixir on a corner or somebody coming in to introduce stoves, what was the benefit of a refrigerator into a home, right? There's an educational component where the buyer goes, oh yeah, right? They start saying yes far before they ever hand over the checkbook. And in today's world, they want to say yes a bunch more and feel like they're understanding what's going on before they ever want to meet somebody to collect their dollars and cents. Like, it's just where are, I think, as a society of information and this digital age that we're in.
It's pretty darn cool how personalized we can get it. And that's, again, that's the difference between marketing and sales, except there isn't a difference anymore. You know, one of my favorite sales books I read years and years ago, there's a story in it about an insurance salesman. And he used to go into people's homes. I mean, that was his job. And he'd get them to fill out paperwork. And what his trick was is while they were filling out paperwork, he would say, oh, shoot, I forgot the pamphlet, the special pamphlet. I left it in my car. You guys keep filling up the paperwork. I'm going to go to my car and I'll come right back with it. And so he would leave, he'd get the pamphlet. He'd come back through the front door, didn't knock or anything, just walk right in because they know he's coming. And now he's got the pamphlet. And he did this every single time. He intentionally would forget the pamphlet. And someone asked him why. And he goes, well, who do you, you don't let salespeople leave and then walk right back in, but you let your friends do that. So what I'm doing here is creating that mental trigger that, well, I walked into their house. I told them I was going to, they're filling out paperwork. It makes sense for me to walk into the house. But by creating that, I've created in them, I've flipped a switch that, oh, I'm more trusting than a salesperson. Well, flip the script on that. Now we have, let's take Amazon, for instance. Amazon sends me push notifications on my phone all day. Well, that's the same thing. Why? I'm not going to let any old app just send me notifications all day. But for some reason, I've let Amazon do it. And they send me notifications. I'm letting them talk to me in my life. And they're building trust with me. And I'm building trust with them. And it's taking that exact same thought process and putting it into marketing.
Yeah, I don't like you for pointing that out, but you're absolutely correct. Here's why I don't like it. I've been railing against the direct messages of people reaching out, you know, cold emails, complete spam. I understand there's a place for outbound marketing. There's a place for warm introductions and creating a relationship. I get all of that. I can't stand the cold spam. And somebody came to me the other day and said, well, what do you think about SMS marketing? I'm like, it'll never take off because that's the last place of my life that's protected. But I think I might be wrong because Amazon, I get texts every day from Amazon. They come in regularly. Oh, we delivered this. Oh, this was just shipped. Oh, this, oh, this, oh, this. And it's like, that's slowly deteriorating the barrier that I have of the intimacy for that particular place, that last line of communication defense, if you will.
Yep. And slowly, you're right. It's, if it happened all at once, we'd fight it. But as long as it slowly integrates itself, I don't know, you almost become used to it. It's, this is an expectation. There's a few obsessions that I have in this world that all revolve around Amazon. And when I get that notification now, it's not a nosy thing. It feels helpful. It's, hey, this thing you wanted is on sale. I'm like, well, thank you, Amazon. That would a nice thing to tell me.
Well, I'm going to tell you this. The day that I wake up and I'm like, man, I didn't get any text from Amazon, I'm going to have to go check myself into an institution.
It's coming. It really is.
I believe you. I don't necessarily like it, but I believe you. Final thoughts, Matt. Wrap us up. Give us some final thoughts on great market research, great market experience, and, you know, delivering personas that don't suck.
Yeah. So first off, I'll push that book again that my friend wrote, The World's Best Buyer Persona System, because it really hones down a lot of my thinking. But remember, when we're talking about personas, you know, it's not about knowing every customer. It's about knowing the ones that matter most to your bottom line. And what does knowing them mean? Well, knowing means, it's like if I was trying to tell my friend, hey, you should try this cheeseburger. It's about being helpful. I'm going to tell him I know he loves cheeseburgers for the taste, and I'm going to sell him on the taste. I'm not trying to sell my friend. I'm just trying to be helpful that he should try a new burger. Marketing is the exact same way. And if you want to do marketing right, you need to know who your friend is. In this case, it's your customer, and you're going to use a written document, which we call a buyer persona, to figure that out.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? This has been a lot of fun. We've kind of been a bit all over the place, but this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your generosity and willingness to share with the audience and folks listening in today. Matt, if they want to reach out to you, how do they get a hold of you? How do they get involved and hook up with research that makes their personas kick ass versus suck ass?
Absolutely. We don't want to suck ass. So you can always find me. My website is s2research.com. So that's s2research.com. That's my tag on Twitter too, at s2research. You could find me on LinkedIn. But seriously, any way you can get in touch with me, everything's on my website. I love talking to people, probably more than I should, as you can hear on this podcast. So by all means, reach out. I love talking to people about research.
That's great. Again, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you, Kyle. I really do appreciate this. This is a good conversation.
Was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For those listening, you can find Matt's contact information in the description of the podcast. You've been listening to me, Kyle Hamer, your host, along with Matt Seltzer, as we've been talking about everything you know about personas and marketing research is wrong. And you know, while you're being wrong, go ahead and be right. Like, subscribe, share, pass the word, and spread it. Thanks again for listening this week. And until next week, keep on being awesome.